Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 27 of our Planet Earth series, in which we look at our home planet. And this evening, our topic is rising seas. Now, the Sentinel-6 satellite that was launched on November the 22nd last year is adding to a long-term sea level data set that has become the gold standard for climate studies from orbit. And just by happenstance, that same Falcon 9 rocket from SpaceX was used at 5:21 this afternoon to launch the double asteroid redirect test from the same launch pad. Well, over the course of nearly three decades, an uninterrupted series of satellites has circled our planet. They have diligently measured sea levels and shown that they are rising at 3.3 millimeters per year. Now, here is an introduction to sea level rise.
Around the globe, sea levels are rising. Greenhouse gas emissions cause our planet to warm, and Earth's oceans absorb about 90% of the excess heat. As ice melts at the poles and high in the mountains, and the molecules of ocean water expand, the seas are making their way onto land. Since 1880, sea levels have risen about 8 to 9 inches. But the seas don't rise uniformly. Some places are at higher risk for flooding, and sea levels are rising faster as time passes. Right now, sea level is rising about 3.3 millimeters per year, 30% faster than in 1992. Here at NASA, we're using satellites, like the new Sentinel-6 Michael Frylich, along with ships and airplanes, to study the processes driving sea level rise and the effects of rising waters.
The continuous record of ocean height that the satellites have built has helped researchers reveal the inner workings of the weather phenomena like El Niño. They have also forecast how much the ocean could encroach on coastlines around the world. The two Sentinel-6 satellites will extend the data set for another decade. Now, as we have heard, the Sentinel-6 Michael Frylich is already in orbit. Its identical twin, Sentinel-6B, will launch in 2025. Sea levels are rising at 3.3 millimeters per year. Now, this is twice the rate at the start of the 20th century. There are several causes for this rise. The ocean absorbs about 90% of the excess heat from the planet's warming climate. Seawater expands as it heats up, resulting in about a third of the modern-day global average sea level rise. But what are the remaining 2 millimeters per year? Well, this feature describes how glaciers are driving sea level rise and the threat to coastal communities.
Greenland and Antarctica are home to most of the world's glacial ice that accumulates on land, including its only two ice sheets. That's why scientists focus their energy here first when looking for answers about sea level rise. Here's a concerning reality. Combined, the two regions contain enough ice that if it were to melt all at once, sea levels would increase by nearly 215 feet. Now, that isn't going to happen anytime soon, but even a few feet of sea level rise, much less 215, would be disastrous for the planet's coastal communities. For most people, these processes are happening so far away that it's hard to imagine how melting at the poles even occurs. Let's lay some groundwork. A healthy glacier is one that accumulates the same amount of snowfall as it loses. It's a system in balance. Unfortunately, today's glaciers and ice sheets are not in balance. Here's what that actually looks like. In Greenland, when warm summer air melts the surface of a glacier, the meltwater drills holes down through the ice. It makes its way down to the bottom of the glacier, where it runs between the ice and the bedrock, and eventually shoots out in a plume at the base of the glacier. The meltwater plume is lighter because it doesn't contain salt. It's fresh water. It rises toward the surface, mixing warm, salty ocean water upward in the process. The warm water then rubs up against the bottom of the glacier, causing even more of the glacier to melt. This often leads to calving, where ice cracks and breaks off into large icebergs. In addition to melting caused by warm air and a warm ocean, Antarctica faces another challenge: the bedrock itself. Researchers often split Antarctica into two regions, East and West. Unlike East Antarctica, the bedrock that makes up West Antarctica is below sea level, which means it's actually underwater. Warmer water has an easier time seeping in between the continental shelf and the ice sheet, melting the ice from below. This causes the ice shelves to thin and break off into the ocean. Melting and ice loss have accelerated at both poles in recent years. The more we learn about this complicated process, the more accurately we'll be able to predict sea level rise far into the future.
In some places, sea levels are rising much faster than the global average of 3.3 millimeters per year. This is because the land in those areas is subsiding. So here is why movements of the land affect sea level in coastal regions.
Across our planet, sea levels are on the rise. And while our changing climate is a huge driver, the movement of the land itself is also an important factor. Around 20,000 years ago, ice sheets covered large areas of our planet. In many places, the weight of these massive ice sheets pressed down on the planet's crust and the viscous mantle underneath. This weight caused the surrounding land to rise and the sea levels to fall relative to that rising land. Over time, these ice sheets began to retreat as part of Earth's natural cycle of glaciation and melt. And as a result, this land began to rebound. Land rose up, and previously uplifted land sank, or subsided, causing the sea level to rise relative to the ground. This adjustment of the land in many previously glaciated regions continues to this day, particularly in areas like the east coast of the United States. Today, if we were to travel to a region like Greenland, where massive ice sheets are now retreating due to a changing climate, we could see the land readjusting in the same way to the lessening load. This also alters the shape of corresponding ocean basins, leading to additional subsidence along coastlines. Subsidence can also result from human activity. For example, we could see that many coastal cities rely on underground aquifers for fresh water. However, when water is extracted, it causes sediment to compact and the ground above to subside. This leads to additional sea level rise for these communities. We live on a dynamic planet that is constantly in motion. And understanding the many drivers of sea level rise is critical to anticipating and adapting to our ever-changing home.
The problem of high tide flooding in the eastern United States is described in this feature from the Goddard Space Flight Center.
High tide flooding is the leading edge of the sea level rise problem.
We've been following the data for decades. Going back 50 years, we experienced flooding like that maybe four times a year, where a roadway would be totally flooded and impassable. Most recently in 2018, we had 52 days of flooding. And so the frequency is increasing and the severity, the depth of the water is increasing as well.
Over the past decade or so, we've seen very high rates of sea level rise along all coasts of the U.S. So the U.S. West Coast, the Gulf Coast, and also the East Coast. And if you look at a global map of the ocean and the satellite altimeter measured sea level trends, the U.S. really stands out as this hot spot with all coastlines going up very rapidly.
You know, it's causing disruption in people's lives. Patience is starting to be lost in some of these communities. And it's a struggle. But it's not just a local problem. It's really a national problem as we want to deal with the increased risk of coastal flooding due to sea level rise now and as we move into the future.
As sea level continues to increase, as ice melts, the ocean expands due to global warming, we're going to continue to see these effects increase. You're going to get more frequent and worse high tide flooding in a lot of locations. And locations that aren't experiencing high tide flooding now, 10, 20, 30 years from now, they will be experiencing high tide flooding on a pretty regular basis.
On top of that, minor meteorological events, so a slightly lowered atmospheric pressure, onshore winds that might, in our case, push up the Chesapeake Bay or push in the Severn River, any of those factors can cause a little bit of an additional rise in water level on top of the astronomical tides.
And we're not talking about extreme winds. We're talking about the kind of winds that we like when we go sailing, 15, 20 knot winds. But it's that kind of variability that is causing flooding to happen at record-breaking instances.
We have seasonal cycles that occur, so over the course of a year, you're going to have a time of the year where sea level is higher than in others. You have what we call interannual to decadal variabilities. So El Nino would be an example of this. So when you have an El Nino that occurs, you have a higher sea level than normal on the U.S. West Coast. And then on even longer timescales than that, we have melting of ice, we have thermal expansion due to global warming that's causing long-term sea level rise.
The other part is, what's land doing? On the East Coast and Gulf Coast, we have a land subsidence issue. Some of that's natural. Compaction of sediments in the Mississippi Delta, you know, glacial isostatic adjustment that's occurring. But there's a part that's unnatural. It's extraction of fresh water for drinking and fossil fuels for consumption. That component can exacerbate relative sea level rise, almost on the same order of magnitude that the ocean is rising itself.
Yeah, so a lot of times we talk about coastal flooding and sea level rise as a future problem. So you see projections out to the end of this century. But in reality, sea level rise and coastal flooding is a problem that we're experiencing now.
Where we're at right now is a road that flooded 41 times last year. And you can see how the road is so much lower than the top of the seawall. Storm drains are really the problem, that the water can come up freely from the Severn River and just backflow right through the storm drains.
And when the tides rise to a certain elevation, the water backs up through the storm drain system and comes out through the storm drains in parking lots, for example. One particular intersection that floods is a main arterial to the downtown area, and so it gets completely closed, and so first responders are impacted. When the parking lot's flooded, then their clients can't park there, or they tend not to even come downtown when these days are reported. It's been documented there's impacts to their revenues upwards of $200,000 a year just due to tidal flooding.
I guess you could say it's sort of a battle between land elevation and water elevation. It's what I've been calling the game of inches. Of all the hundreds of high tides a year, some are just a few inches higher than others. And those are the ones, of course, that are causing flooding now. The real problem, though, is all the high tide events that are just a few inches below, it's only going to take a few inches of additional sea level rise to nudge them upward. So what will happen over time is with sea level rise, we're going to end up not with 20 or 40 flood events, but we'll then be into hundreds of flood events per year.
One of the things that communities are doing is they're preventing water from coming back through the stormwater systems. They call it a backflow preventer. You want to let rain out, but you don't want to let the ocean in.
Some places like Charleston are putting large underground water storage facilities, deep underground, where they can direct rainwater and get it off the city streets and try to hold it there until, you know, after the rainstorm goes. If you have low-lying areas, you may need pump stations to collect rainwater and pump it.
But then there's these other strategies where coastal communities are trying to reduce the amount of pavement they have, for instance, increase the amount of green space they have in these different locations, restoring beachfront. A lot of these different things can reduce the impact of coastal flooding going forward. So NASA has the observations that are really needed to improve our understanding of sea level science. So across the board, we have processes that are contributing to sea level change on a range of timescales, and the variety of satellite observations that we have available to us now really allow us to improve our understanding of these different processes.
What we're doing at NOAA is really trying to give the data to decision makers so that they can make informed decisions that's best for their community. But one thing's for certain is under current flood defenses, these projections suggest that a flood of your future is going to be here in the next few decades, and the way of life is going to have to adapt to this.
I find it rather amusing that an organization called NOAA is looking at flooding. That's NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration of the United States, and not that biblical guy, N-O-A-H. Well, looking closer to home, there are large areas that will be affected. By the end of the century, that's less than 80 years from now, average sea levels around Australia could rise by 1.1 metres. In 2019, I flew to Brisbane. As the aircraft glided down towards a landing, I was astonished to observe that new marina-type housing was being built on marshland east of the airport. And I thought, don't those folks buying these houses know that sea levels are rising? Yeah. Likewise, I've long thought that Patterson Lakes is not a very smart place to build a house. Well, now let's look at the effects and causes of rising sea levels on the west coast of the United States.
From about 1993 to 2010, off the west coast of the United States, we've seen about zero sea level rise or even negative sea level rise, so sea level was falling during that time period. But since about 2010, 2011, we've seen this really rapid increase in sea level off the U.S. West Coast. We're seeing this recovery back towards the global mean. And if this continues to increase, then you'd expect to start to see sea level impacts associated with this increase. Increased coastal erosion, increased high tide flooding, these kinds of things as sea level continues to increase. So there's a number of things happening. One is there's this background increase in sea level associated with global warming, thermal expansion, and the melting of ice, which is impacting sea level along the West Coast. That's causing this long-term increase. But on top of that increase, there's this oscillation that occurs, and actually a number of oscillations. So the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is one of those. The El Nino Southern Oscillation is another. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation is a large-scale climate signal centered in the Pacific Ocean. Every 10 years, we see this shift in the sea level between what we see in the Western Pacific and what we see in the Eastern Pacific. And these oscillations suppress or elevate sea level over different time periods and really either exacerbate or diminish the effects of that long-term sea level. Since about 2010, 2011, we've been seeing this shift in that decadal variability associated with the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And what that's doing is causing sea level along the west coast of the U.S. to go up. So really high rates of sea level causing sea level to shift very dramatically in this increase that we've been seeing in the satellite records and also in some of the tide gauge records along the U.S. coast as well. Sea level is going to change and how it's going to impact the coast, I think, is really important so we can inform people, they can make good decisions for their future, and we can start to adapt and adjust our way of living in order to account for these effects that are going to occur in the future.
on FM, online, and on TuneIn 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
This is planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is planet Earth.
El Nino is a weather pattern triggered by a huge shift in the winds that normally blow from east to west across the equatorial Pacific Ocean. And El Nino can shift ocean currents and global weather patterns. This can bring torrential rain to southwestern North America and droughts to Asia and Australia. Its counterpart, La Nina, can have the opposite effect, and that's what we have right at the moment. One of the discoveries to come out of the satellite sea level data set is the far-reaching effects that El Nino and La Nina can have on the world. In 2010, there was a massive La Nina, and it essentially flooded huge parts of Australia and Southeast Asia. It rained so much on land, it dropped global sea levels by 1 centimetre. Yes, 1 centimetre. Scientists had no idea La Nina could have such a massive impact on global sea level. Of course, this water eventually flowed back into the ocean, so the drop in level was only temporary. One satellite is able to measure how much rain is falling around the globe. This is the Global Precipitation Measurement, or GPM, satellite. Now, rainfall can affect road, air, and sea transport, so data from GPM is useful.
When it comes to extreme weather, commercial, federal, state, and local agencies need all the fast and reliable data they can get to make the best decisions when things are uncertain.
Weather is responsible for more air traffic delays, reroutes, and diversions than any other reason. So that satellite data and the tools that they provide help the traffic flow managers in both the FAA and for the airlines to getting better understanding of what those hazards are, where they're at, and what they're forecast to be, so that we can either mitigate them or just work around them.
From the vantage point from space, NASA and partner satellites provide critical information to aviation, shipping, state transportation departments, and logistics industries. NASA's cutting-edge technology brings unprecedented views of the Earth, giving us a closer look inside cloud systems, lightning, dangerous storms, severe weather over land and far offshore, beyond what traditional radars can observe.
We are a MetOcean data analytics company, and we do numerical modeling to describe the ocean in 4 dimensions.
We have these numerical prediction capabilities to essentially tell people, the users, the ocean conditions, the currents, temperature, wave, and so on and so forth in any part of the global oceans.
The information gathered by satellites can help decision makers adapt to quickly changing situations and make travel and transport safer and more efficient. NASA is creating awareness of precipitation and cloud data to help inform critical operation decisions today and into the future.
We have many wonderful programs here on Southern FM. One of my favourites is A Newsman and His Music, presented by Colin Tyrus. You can hear it from 9 to 11 o'clock on Monday mornings. Now, a great surprise several weeks ago when Colin played a song by Midnight Oil. A surprise because I had never heard of it before, and its theme is right bang on the theme of this evening's The Space Show. Here is Midnight Oil with Rising Seas.
Every child, put down your toys and come inside to sleep. We have to look you in the eye and say we sold you cheap. Let's confess, we did not act with serious urgency. So open up the floodgates to the rising sea.
Let's get started. Why am I here? Well, I'm an oceanographer and I study the oceans using data from NASA satellites of all different kinds, but I'm also the lead NASA scientist for the Sentinel-6 and JASON missions, which measure sea level from space. So what I really want to talk to you about tonight is climate change, or the warming of our planet. Now, when we think of the planet warming, we typically think of the atmosphere warming. And this is not just any temperature, it's the average temperature of the entire planet. And this tells us a very simple story that the Earth is getting warmer, and it's getting warmer pretty fast. A degree of warming, a degree Celsius of warming, may not seem like a lot, but it's actually a huge change to our climate, and it's happening right now. And the big question, of course, is why? And the answer is actually us. We are actually warming the planet's climate by adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere and increasing the amount of heat that we trap from the sun. Now, if we look back in time at the record of carbon dioxide since about 500,000 years ago, it looks something like this, where you can see carbon dioxide's gone up and down and up and down for about every 100,000 years. And right now, we were actually in a warm period. About 20,000 years ago, we were in a cold period, and carbon dioxide levels were low on the planet. And then it started to warm up naturally. It warmed up, and we've been in a warm period for about 10,000 years. And during that time, CO2 increased in the atmosphere, and we trapped more and more heat. But if you look back at the last 500,000 years, carbon dioxide today is higher than at any time in the last 500,000 years. And the reason why is we've been burning fossil fuels, which add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and this is trapping extra heat. Now, how does that happen? Well, extra heat is actually added to the atmosphere. When sunlight passes through the atmosphere, it actually warms the surface of the Earth, and that warm surface sends heat back out towards space. But as the heat goes back towards space, it's actually different than the light coming from the sun. The light coming from the sun is in the form of visible light, and it goes right through the atmosphere. But the energy that heads back out towards space gets stuck. And the amount that gets stuck depends on how much carbon dioxide there is in the atmosphere. So if we trap this extra heat in the atmosphere, if we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, we trap the extra heat and keep it from leaving back out towards space. So what happens to the heat? Now, I said at the beginning, I'm an oceanographer, so you probably have a hint. But you may not realize just how big an influence the ocean is on our planet's climate. Over 90% of the extra heat that we're trapping with the greenhouse gases is warming the oceans. The atmosphere is warming up. But in fact, the real action, the real place where most of global warming is occurring, is in the oceans. You can think of the atmosphere as sort of like a piece of aluminum foil wrapped around a potato in the oven. If you reach into an oven that's 350 degrees and you grab a piece of aluminum foil, it actually won't burn you if it's all by itself, because the aluminum foil can't carry that much heat. But if you wrap it around a hot potato, then you're in big trouble. And the oceans are sort of like the world's heat potato. They trap over 90% of this heat, and they can absorb heat very quickly and very efficiently. So really, when we think about global warming, we should be thinking about ocean warming, because that's where most of it is happening. Now, as the planet warms, we see effects all over the world. The oceans are warming, the air is warming, and as this happens, we can see that ice around the planet is actually melting as well. And this is something that's actually happening all over the planet. Over 90% of all the glaciers in the world are retreating and getting smaller as the climate warms. And as that happens, it actually raises sea levels around the planet as well, because the ice that's lost from the glaciers runs off into the oceans and adds that extra water to the ocean level, raising sea levels everywhere. Now, we know that sea levels are rising for some really interesting reasons, but one of my favorite, most interesting records is this record of sea level change from North Carolina, along the coast, collected in a salt marsh. And this is one of my colleagues who went out and they drill holes to this salt marsh and dig up the mud, and it gives them a record back in time of how high sea level was along the North Carolina coast. And if you look back at the record, you can actually see that from the year zero to about 1000, sea levels really were not changing in the Atlantic Ocean. They were very stable. And that's because we had reached a warm climate and sea levels had stopped rising after the end of the last ice age. And they were really very stable. And then about 1000 AD, we entered what was called the medieval warm period. And this was a period where there was a little bit of warming and there's a little bit of sea level rise. After that, in about 1500, there was the little ice age where there was a small amount of cooling, so maybe sea levels fell just a little bit. But what really leaps out in this record is the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. In the 1850s or so, we began adding a lot of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. We began heating up the planet, and sea levels began to take off and rocket upward. And the salt marshes actually tell the same story as the tide gauge, which goes back over 100 years nearby in this location. And they both show that sea levels were rising very quickly after the Industrial Revolution began. So what's happening to our oceans is something that hasn't happened in thousands of years. And it's a reminder of just how big an impact we're having on the climate. Now, of course, I've talked a lot about climate change, but where is NASA in all this? Well, NASA actually flies satellites that measure sea level directly. And this is the Sentinel-6 satellite. It works in a very simple way. It bounces a radar off of the ocean and measures how long it takes to go down and come back up. This tells the satellite how far away the water is. And then using positioning systems like GPS and a couple of others, we can tell where the satellite is. So if we know where the satellite is and how far away the water is, we can say how high the water is, how high sea levels are everywhere in the world once every 10 days. And this gives us a really powerful tool for measuring sea level rise, and one that we've actually been using for almost 30 years now. But as we heard at the very beginning of the program, our latest sea level mission, Sentinel-6 Michael Freilich, was launched on November 21st, 2020. And this is actually the most accurate mission to date to measure global sea levels. It'll give us all kinds of really fascinating information. But one of the most important things is it's the satellite so nice we built it twice. In fact, there's two Sentinel-6 satellites. The Sentinel-6 Michael Freilich was launched last year, and in 2025, an exact copy of the satellite will launch and replace the Sentinel-6 Michael Freilich satellite. So each one will last 5 years, giving us a 10-year extension to our record of sea level rise, which goes back to the early 1990s. Now, the launch of Michael Freilich was kind of exciting because it launched on a rocket that went up, but the rocket actually came back down and it landed on the same launch pad it took off from. I was there and it was kind of an exciting day because when the rocket came back down, it's going faster than the speed of sound, so it creates a sonic boom. And I happened to get a little video of it where you can hear the sonic boom. So if you're listening to this really loud, you may want to turn your volume down a little bit. Well, it wasn't just the rocket that made a boom that day. In fact, Sentinel-6 Michael Freilich was a huge boom for advancing our knowledge of sea level rise. And the fact that it launched successfully was incredibly satisfying. And in fact, we've gotten the very first data back from it was released in June publicly. And I mentioned that Michael Freilich, the Sentinel-6 Michael Freilich satellite was part of a set of missions that go back to the early 1990s. And this gives us a sense of just how lucky we are in the oceanographic community and the climate community to have had a series of satellites that go all the way back to 1992, which starting with Topex Poseidon, which is actually the satellite that got me my PhD. That satellite and its successor, Jason 1, Jason 2, and now Jason 3, have overlapped from one after the next, going all the way back to 1992. And that overlap's incredibly important because it gives us a continuous record of how sea level's changing that is incredibly accurate. In fact, it is so accurate that we can measure the rise of the oceans with an accuracy of just about half a centimeter once every 10 days. And so every 10 days, we get this incredibly accurate look at the average height of the entire planet. Now, that's a huge feat because remember, more than 2/3 of the planet's surface are covered by oceans. So as we watch the sea levels change globally, we're literally watching how the Earth is reshaped one week after the next. And when we look at the data up and down that happens every year, this sort of rise and fall in global sea level, and this is actually due to the exchange of water between the oceans and the land. Every year in the summertime in the northern hemisphere, the ocean evaporates lots of water up into the atmosphere and it rains down over land. It takes that water some time to reach the ocean again, and during that time, sea level actually falls until the water begins to run back off, and the seasonal cycle shifts to the southern hemisphere, and sea levels begin to rise again. So this rise and fall of the oceans, which is about a centimeter every year, or that is sort of like the heartbeat of our planet. It's like the exchange of water is really telling us how our planet's changing in an incredibly detailed way. But what's fascinating really to me is that if you look at this record that goes back from the early 1990s to today, the most visible part of it, the thing that jumps out at you the most, is the steady rise of the oceans. And I say steady, but it's actually really not steady because the rate of rise has increased. But in the early 90s, the rate of rise was about 2 millimeters per year. In the 2000s, it was 3 millimeters per year. And today, it's between 4 and 5 millimeters per year. So we're literally watching the rate of sea level rise increase from one decade to the next. And it's satellites like the Sentinel-6 Michael Freilich mission and the Jason missions before it that allow us to do this. Now, I want to shift gears just a little bit here and talk for a second about the causes of this rise. And one of the reasons we're seeing this increase in sea level is the melting of the ice sheets. Now, NASA has another neat tool in collaboration with the German Space Agency. It's called the GRACE mission, or now the GRACE follow-on mission. And this satellite is actually a pair of satellites. These two satellites chase each other around the Earth. Their names are Tom and Jerry, in fact, just like the cartoon characters. And whenever the first one goes over something heavy, the pull of gravity causes it to speed up and move away from the second satellite just a little bit. So what we do is we measure the distance between the two satellites very, very accurately, and by watching them move together and apart, we can infer how heavy the things are that we're flying over. So for instance, when we fly over a mountain with this satellite, we see the satellites pull apart at the beginning and then come back together when the mountain is between them. So using this information, we can literally weigh the continents. And when we weigh the continents or the islands like Greenland that are covered in ice, we see that the ice in Greenland is actually disappearing. That represents tons and tons of ice that are being lost from the edges of the ice sheet. And during the last 15 or so years, Greenland has lost 5 trillion tons of ice, and that's enough to raise sea levels by more than a centimeter. So this rise that we're seeing in the oceans is directly driven by the loss of ice in the great ice sheets like Greenland.
Speaking in California a few weeks ago, that was Josh Willis, the lead scientist for the Sentinel-6 mission at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And Josh will be back in a few moments.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is Planet Earth.
Earth. 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
Josh Willis has many strings to his bow, and one of them is on a satellite called SWOT, which is going to be launched in 2022.
I want to talk about the future of these kinds of missions to study sea level. And at NASA and the in collaboration with the French space agency, CNES, and also with the Canadians and the British, we're hoping to launch in 2022, late 2022, the next revolution in sea level measuring missions from space. This is called SWOT, which stands for Surface Water and Ocean Topography. And essentially what it will do is look down and measure sea level, but instead of measuring it in one small spot and taking 10 days to fly around the world and cover pretty much the entire oceans, SWOT will measure an entire swath of the ocean all at once as it flies by. And this will sweep out a much finer look at the oceans. You can think of it as sort of like turning in your old standard definition TV and getting a high definition TV, or maybe even a 4K TV. SWOT will allow us to see very small structures in the ocean, allow us to see sea level as it changes right up next to the coastline, and really be a powerful tool for measuring how the oceans are changing their shape over time. It's exciting too because it will also allow hydrologists, folks who study water on land, a much broader look at lakes and rivers all around the world. So it's a really exciting mission coming down the pipeline. It'll launch in 2022 and we're all really excited about it.
And Josh Willis came to us courtesy of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Early in November last year, the Bureau of Meteorology and CSIRO released its State of the Climate 2020 report. It predicts an increase in extreme fire weather, a significant decline in rainfall across southeast Australia, and almost guarantees more coral bleaching. Even by the end of this year, extreme flooding could affect New South Wales and cyclones could sweep into Queensland. The report found Australia's climate had warmed by 1.44 Celsius since 1910. Fewer cyclones are likely to hit northern Australia over the next decade, but those that do will be of higher intensity and be more destructive than in the past. In September, the Bureau declared a La Nina event in the Pacific Ocean. This means that tropical cyclones are twice as likely to make landfall in Australia this summer. The 2020 State of the Climate Report says that 8 of the 10 warmest years of sea surface temperatures have been recorded since 2010. The average sea surface temperature in Australia has warmed by 1 degree Celsius since 1900. Marine heat waves are predicted to become far more frequent, extensive, and long-lasting. The Great Barrier Reef this year had the third mass bleaching event since 2010. Rapidly recurring bleaching events do not give the reef ecosystems time to recover. To make matters worse, carbon dioxide dissolved in seawater are changing the acidity of the oceans. Their carbonic acid eats away at the carbonate shells of marine organisms.
Earth below us, drifting